your tears on my pillow that won't dry on the road beyond my ears. I've no sorrow, but today I don't walk alone. Step by step,
step by day,
I'm on the round to recovery, trusting God along the way, trusting God along the way, trusting God all the way.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group's Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. I've asked Chris to come up here and tell us a joke.
How's everybody doing tonight?
Okay, so what did the alcoholic philosophy student say? I drink, therefore I am.
Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Fred. Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation. So please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices that make noise that might or will distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. Is everybody ready? Let's start the meditation. Say the fog light prayer. If you don't know it, it's right here behind me. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light. From there is a solution from the big book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Rhonda to read Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience. We read this notice. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know what one is.
Spiritual experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon carefully reading shows that the personality change significant to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experience must be in the nature of sudden or spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of the sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it is not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed by once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences the psychologist William James calls the educational variety because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been about himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that we have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think that the awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious memberships call it God consciousness. Most empathetically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but they are not indispensable, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contact prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
Please refrain from disturbing others or talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so set your phones to airplane or meeting mode or just turn them off. So this is the beginning of Joe doing his 12-step series. From what I know, he is a man who walks the walk. I've seen him the whole time. He's sitting there meditating, connecting with God before this meeting, and I was watching him the whole time. And I'm excited for what God has to speak through him tonight, and let's all welcome Joe.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic and a member of the Wednesday night Big Book Study Group. My name is Joe. Good to be here. Excuse me one second. What I was doing with my eyes closed was begging God. Because, you know, when I get to do one of these things, I go to that place where my brain, you know, I try to think of things to open with or talk about or how to proceed. And my brain just goes to scrambled eggs. It just goes crazy. I mean, I can't bring into my mind with sufficient force anything that I would start with. And so I just really beg and I pray that whatever I convey to you is the message. And the message is all about him. And, you know, but it starts in the beginning. And, you know, I was a guy that ended up with my life being absolutely nowhere. All my scorecards read zero. You know, I felt like a complete loser. I felt like a failure. I didn't like me at all. You know, I had gotten to the place where I literally hated my guts. I couldn't stand me. I had done so many things that broke so many hearts and hurt people over and over. And, you know, the collateral damage was, it just seemed like it was such a mountain that I couldn't possibly begin to straighten out the past. And, you know, the book talks about that, you know, that jumping off place, wishing for the end. And, you know, I was there. I really felt that at that point, that if I was going to have to live another minute, somebody was going to have to give me a vision of life and a promise that it was going to be completely different than what I had experienced. I come from a good family, a beautiful family. You know, it's certainly not my upbringing that got me to the place of complete and utter despair. But it was this pursuit of life that I had done that brought me to that place. The place of wanting to take myself out. So I met this guy. His name was John Williams. And he passed recently. He was sober for 40 plus years. And he was just one of those guys where I saw things about him that if I could just acquire some of those things that I saw in him, it would be enough. And, you know, he was one of those guys that I couldn't imagine or picture loaded or drunk. He was just a man of integrity and a man of honor, principled and fully self-expressed. You know, he didn't care about what people thought of him. And all my life I was just consumed and crippled, right, with what people thought of me. And I was making it all up, right? You know, I told you that I had come to that place where dying was more attractive than living to me. So he appeared, and I went to this meeting, and he was there, and you know, he subsequently became my sponsor. And he was a guy that was a real student of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God. You know, and that, listen, for 16 years I'd been going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous with an alcoholic mind, with untreated alcoholism, with the same mind. I wasn't recovering, I was detoxing and I was retoxing. I was detoxing and retoxing, no change in between. So certainty was that I would go back out. I mean, that was the story of my life for a lot of years. And, you know, I had become disgusted with AA because of what I thought AA was. You know, I just thought it was a don't drink, go to meetings, and your life's going to take off and be wonderful. And little did I know that, you know, I had developed some things within me that were really paralyzing. They just, you know, they stifled any kind of intimacy or authenticity or any kind of relationships that I would have with people. And you know, those were the things that were the byproducts of the manifestations of what I had done to other people. You know, I became a habitual liar and a thief and just a real performer, just a real masquerader. I didn't even know who I was, to be quite honest with you. I didn't know what I stood for. And so if this was what AA was going to give me, I might as well just check out because, you know, I've tried this thing and it didn't work. And lo and behold, I went to that one meeting that somebody had invited me to that I didn't want to go to because he said it was a big book study. I said, I don't want to go to one of those. I want to go for, how boring could that be? And I went and I met John, and my life started to change. You know, for the first time in my life, he was talking about the doctor's opinion, and for the first time in 16 years of going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I understood what he was talking about. He, you know, there's certain people that can convey a message where you absolutely, like, holy, like, you know, the spiritual experience sound. Ah, like, oh my God, that's what you're talking about. That's what that is. That's what's going on with me. And I was, I mean, things were revealed that night, and he was just beginning in the doctor's opinion. And I didn't know that that AA existed. You see, I had been trying to get sober on Fellowship Recovery for a lot of years, and it didn't work. I thought I could just come in for an hour a day or an hour, a couple hours a week and attend, and that that would provide the much-needed relief. But I didn't understand what was going on with me. I didn't understand why I always felt miserable, why I always felt like the past was just, you know, like it was the monster that was devouring me. And, you know, the future was just nothing but a ball of anxiety. And I was so lost. And come to find out that there's really very specific reasons why I felt the way I felt. And there's a very clear-cut set of directions on going out of that stuff. You know, this internal condition, this thing that, that I began to harbor on the inside consumed me. And it was the result of what I did to people. You know, I have a very loving family. I broke their hearts. I stole from them. I lied to them. I manipulated them. I deceived them. Gained them for years, even in and out of AA, even when I would have these small amounts of time. And the worst part about the thing that happens when we start to hurt people and deceive them and lie to them and cut corners and start stealing and, you know, get locked up and disappear and, you know, go through all that kind of thing, I started to develop these things inside me that were a direct result of those actions. And, you know, one of them was shame. You know, I don't think anybody knows shame like a real alcoholic. Despair, loneliness, regret, remorse, bitterness, feeling like a failure, feeling like a complete loser. That's how I felt. I hated me. I hated what I had come to in my life. And I've been college educated and I brought up in a good family. This was all on my doing. Whatever I had was never good enough. I was never okay with what I had, ever. You know, so I lived in envy and I lived in greed and I lived in lust and coveting other people's stuff. That's where I lived in my mind. I was entrenched and addicted to the world, period. And even though my family brought me up in a religious background and put me through, parochial schools and this and that, I never had once made a conscious decision to develop a relationship with God, ever. I was consumed with my relationship with the world and what I didn't have and what I wanted. That was it, right? So I had never developed any kind of a spiritual access or spiritual mindset or anything of that nature. I heard people talk about God, but I really didn't engage in that kind of conversation. It was always about stuff. And, you know, in my mind, I was playing it over and over and over. What did I have to do to have you think I was okay? What did I have to do to have you applaud me, to recognize me, to validate me, to make you think that I had it going on? For decades. So I had moved further and further away from who I truly was born to be. And I think we all do that. I think most of us do that. The God of my understanding at all those years was you. You know, if you thought I was a good guy, or you thought I was this, or you thought I was that, maybe I'd feel like that on the inside, because it was all fraudulent to begin with. So I started to develop this internal condition that was rotting me from the inside out. Come to find out through this work that, and through the doctor's opinion and the first, you know, all the information that we read prior to chapter 4, was that was the thing that I was covering up. I was feeling all those things in AA, and the reason I would always go back out, that internal condition always preceded the obsession of the mind, always preceded the lie that I would tell myself that it would be different this time. See, I didn't know I was medicating and drinking. to give that condition relief. That's what I was doing. That condition was always going to scream from the inside out that I needed relief for that. Right? So it would get me to the point where I would concoct this idiotic lie. It'll be different this time. Nobody will know. You know, whatever that lie is. That was sufficient enough for me to put the poison in my body that was literally killing me. Right? The worst part about that internal condition is pretending to everybody else that it doesn't exist. Right? Feeling like a loser. Feeling like a failure. Feeling like I'll never get this thing. All the regret and all the shame and all the remorse, embarrassment and all that stuff. And pretend like it doesn't exist. So I come to find out, as we all do, if we read the doctor's opinion and we study it, that, you know, the reason that we drink is for ease and comfort, right? We drink for ease and comfort. Well, okay, so my sober condition, my undrunk condition, if I still got that stuff going on the inside, just because I quit drinking doesn't mean that goes anywhere. It gets louder, louder and louder and louder. Now I'm not drinking. I'm trying to, you know, interact in the fellowship and, you know, do that deal, having that stuff go on, right? And the only thing I'm looking for is relief, 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 relief. And it says we can become restless, irritable, and discontent unless we can again sense the ease and comfort that comes in a split second by taking a drink. You see, that's always there. Because when I was in that condition, and I think anybody that's in that condition, the only thing that I can recall is what it did for me rather than what it did to me. Right? I can only remember what the booze did for me. It's all part of that obsessive lie to where I ultimately tell myself a lie because I can't drink on the truth. That gives that I feel is sufficient enough to give me reason to drink. And then he says we suffer from this thing physically. He called it a phenomenon of craving. That once we ingest alcohol, that something happens in me that doesn't happen in a normal drinker. It doesn't happen in somebody that's a moderate drinker, right? Where they can drink it and leave it alone or put it down and that's it. Something happens to a real alcoholic that when I ingest it, he called it a phenomenon. It's since been proven to be a physiological fact that this demand is created. So in really simple terms, it's like, so when I start, I can't moderate. I can't stop. But that's not the worst part about it, because a lot of us have stopped 1,000 times. Want to stop, slap a cop. You'll stop, right? 6 months now, I think. The problem wasn't stopping. The problem was staying stopped. The problem was not starting. Right? And if I continued to walk around with that internal condition and untreated alcoholism, it's certain that I'm going to cave to that demand. There's no doubt about it. So if I can't stop and I can't stay stopped when I start, I got a death sentence. I have a death sentence that dooms me to drink myself to death. And my goodness, we all know somebody that has died as a direct result of this disease. We all know many. I mean, like, what, 60,000 last year? Some crazy number. Doesn't matter what substance it is that we're addicted to. Right? The question for all of us is if you're new here, this is the question for you. I'm not really here to speak to those that know. I'm here to speak to those that are questioning it, that don't know, that don't do that deep dive to really answer and concede to our innermost selves if I really have this thing. And it doesn't take a whole lot to figure it out. If when I put it in, I can't stop. Right? And if when I'm stopped, I can't stop starting. It is what it is. Probably very few white chippers in this room. Right? most of us got to be really, really badly mangled before we're able to connect the dots and put the evidence together with the help of somebody that knows to where we're able to acknowledge it, right? This book is like the most incredible masterpiece that I've ever read. I mean, it's a book that's written strictly about me. And one of the things my sponsor pointed out in the beginning, he said, let's go to the preface and see what kind of book this is. Because I didn't know. It says it's our basic text. Well, I've heard of textbooks before. That, at least, I did know. They used to give me textbooks when I went to school. And I knew they were books of instruction. They weren't books of suggestion. They were books of actual direction and instruction. If I wanted to learn how to do algebra, right, you got to go to the book. You don't just try to aimlessly find that information out. So that's the first thing that was important to me, is that there is a text for this program called Recovery that upon further investigation, I found out that the actual program, the book, the actual book was called Alcoholics Anonymous First. That's what they named this book. Right? Not the fellowship. The fellowship came as a result of them gathering, but the book was named AA First, Alcoholics Anonymous, of which our fellowship took its name. So the book came first. The program of recovery came first. If I'm going to have this spiritual awakening that they're talking about that happens through the first 9 steps, right? That there's some very specific things that I'm going to have to follow and I'm going to have to investigate on my part in order to have that prize happen in my life. I'm not going to get it by just simply going to a meeting and listening. I'm going to have to actually do the investigation. So how it works, we hear it at every meeting. A, that we're alcoholic and couldn't manage our own lives. And know exactly what that means. The first 3 chapters, including the doctor's opinion, right? That information is all about step 1. When we hit We Agnostics, we begin step 2. So there's a lot of information before I get to how it works to be able to concede 3 things to myself in my heart and have it really live inside me that this information is accurate and it's absolutely happened in my life. Okay. A, that we're alcoholic and couldn't manage our own life. Well, what does that mean? Well, the doctor's opinion says this. It says, in the statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. Doesn't say should believe. Or you might want to think about it. It says must believe. That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It didn't satisfy us to be told that we couldn't control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life or that we were in full flight from reality or outright mental defectives. Right? It says these things were true to some extent. In fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is complete. You know, this is the first guy, the first medical man to say something like that in recorded history. Wow. Because you know what it was before that? We were just weak-willed, immoral sinners. That's what we were. We just didn't know how to handle our liquor. People didn't know. But society deemed us mentally defective. Matter of fact, they used to lock us up in asylums, right? All the time. Or prison, jail, or we'd just die on the street, right? That was it. There wasn't anything else. So, very good information because, you know, he treated over 40,000 of us, right? He treated people for drugs, he treated people for alcohol, and we would come in. And I'm sure he saw a lot of the same faces. Time after time after time. Coming in, getting undrunk and undrugged through the detox treatment that they had back then, and sending us out the door that we came in probably saying, good luck. And these were people that were a mix like us. Some from very high up in society, some from middle society, some from lower society. Right? But we all, what he'd notice is that there would be something that would happen or something that was coming up where we would take a drink and then we were down for the count. The next time he'd see us is coming through the door to get detoxed. Right? So he knew that there was something going on in the body as well. He called it a phenomenon of craving. It's since been proven to be a physiological demand that is created within us after we ingest the allergen or alcohol. I think he called it an allergy simply because it was a word that fit. This abnormal reaction to a food, a beverage, or a substance. Right? What was the abnormal reaction? This craving, this demand that, you know, we couldn't stop. We couldn't moderate. Now, if you're a real alcoholic or you're addicted to anything and that happens to you when you put it in, then you got the first piece of the puzzle. You got the first piece of the puzzle. Because if you can control it or put it down based on the decision to do so, you're not one of us. It's just that simple, right? Why would we be here if you weren't one of us? If you didn't have that thing going on, right? And then he talks about this. You know, he says that we drink for the ease and comfort. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while we admit it is injurious or causing injury, we can't after a time differentiate the true from the false. To us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. You know what that sounds like? It's your fault. Not my fault. You know, it's my lot in life. It's the police. It's this, it's that, the other. We become these consummate victims where we're blaming everybody else and everything on our problems. But we can't see the truth that it's actually being manifested by drinking the alcohol. It is what it is. And then he says, and this is, by the way, he's talking about a undrunk person at this point. He says, they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks we see others taking with impunity. Do you know I have been looking for ease and comfort all my life? I never felt quite normal. You know, I never felt quite adequate. I always had that self-doubt thing going on, that self-conscious thing going on, even when I would have many friends. Right? I would always gravitate towards the popular, that like the people that were the rebels and the people that were getting in trouble. Because you know why? They got the most notoriety. They were the most popular people. So I would like chameleon my way in there so I would be considered cool like them. Not because I was like them, because I wanted the notoriety. I wanted to be popular. There was always that sense of inadequacy inside me. Ease and comfort was always something I was looking for. And you know, when I started drinking, when I started doing other things, I found that ease and comfort. But it was by nothing that I was doing on the outside. It was all coming from the booze and the drugs. It finally numbed me out and gave me the relief that I was looking for, that I didn't care about what you thought of me. I didn't care about what you said about me. I was consumed with that. Ease and comfort. What a huge part of my life that was, always chasing that. It says this ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks, right? It says after they have succumbed. Now this is, again, he's talking about an undrunk person at this moment. After they've succumbed, which simply means, in our case, in his case, putting it in our body, to the desire again. So in other words, he's saying that we succumb to the desire. He's saying that this happens first and then this happens. So whatever I'm thinking, whatever I'm feeling, whatever I'm going through at the time creates some kind of a desire to medicate. Right? The obsession of the mind, this internal condition, this all-consuming conversation that's going on in my mind about the unease in my life, and or perhaps whatever the situation is at the moment, is driving me towards getting the relief. The allergy of the body will never stop being aggravated by us unless the obsession of the mind is relieved first. We have to be get rid of the obsession before we'll ever stop. The mind always comes first. It was explained to me like this, that any kind of emotion, anything that I'm going through, everything that I do, every feeling that I feel, every emotion I have, every action I take there's an ancestor to all of it. And it's called a thought. Right? I have to think about it before I do it. So the thoughts are ongoing. If the thoughts don't change, people, I'm not going to change. Nothing's going to happen with my alcoholism or addiction. I think the thought produces a feeling or an emotion. The feeling and emotion produce an action, and the action produces a result. My sponsor said, if you want to change the outcome of your life, it's not about the actions you take. And it's not about the feelings or the emotions you have. It's about the thoughts that you have. That's why Silkworth said this, I believe. Says this. After they have succumbed to the desire, again, the desire is created because of the condition I'm in the internal condition. As so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, start, I can't stop. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree or binge, emerging remorseful. God, so like an alcoholic. So like this alcoholic. You know, every time I'd come out of it, I'm so sorry. Just a nauseating, vomit-producing idiot, right? With a firm resolution not to do it again. So as soon as I get done groveling, it's like, I'll never do that again. I'll never do it. I'll never touch that stuff again. Nothing could ever make me do that again. You know, you hear it in treatment all the time. This resolve, this steadfast resolve. And the next thing I know, I'm drinking again. Right? With a firm resolution not to drink again. It says this is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, a.k.a. spiritual awakening, a.k.a. spiritual experience, a.k.a. profound alteration in my reaction to life, there's very little hope of my recovery. You know, when I read that, for the first time in my life, I knew why I couldn't stay stopped. Because I had never pursued one of those. And when it was explained to me, I said, my God, how do you get one of those? He says, well, I'm glad you asked. Right? There's only one way. There's only one way. And it's not just simply going to meet. Meetings are vital. They are absolutely crucial. they give me an opportunity to carry this message to help other people out of the depths of hell that I came from. But it's not going to give me the essential psychic change. Mom and dad couldn't give it to me. Sisters and brothers couldn't give it to me. And God, they pleaded with me. They begged me. Judge couldn't give it to me. Cops couldn't give it to me. No treatment center could give it to me. No detox gave it to me. No human power. None. Especially that idiot that was looking back at me in the mirror. No human power could relieve me of my alcoholism or keep me stopped. Because I always started again. I always started again. Right? So what is somebody to do? Right? It says that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. So anytime you have an allergy to anything, you have a you have symptoms, right? You have the manifestation that, results in symptoms. If you have hay fever, you're going to sneeze and eyes running and nose running and all that kind of stuff. If you get exposed to it and ingest the allergen or get exposed to it. If you eat strawberries and you have an allergy to strawberries, you're going to break out in a red rash. That's just the way it is. If you have an allergy to penicillin or peanut oil, you're going to swell. You're going to, you know, your throat's going to close. If you have an allergy to shrimp, same thing's going to happen, right? I mean, if you have an allergy to any specific allergen, you're going to have symptoms if you ingest it. And Silkworth simply said, you have an allergy to alcohol, Joe. That's why you can't stop when you start. And it made perfect sense to me. There were so many times I said, I only have a couple. I'm only going to go out for an hour. I'm only going to do this. I'm only going to do that. I'm only going to smoke a 20. Whatever, right? Never happened. Never, ever happened. I'd be so blind drunk sitting at a bar where I couldn't even stand up and I'd have to have another drink. Now, there's something wrong with that. I would drink myself into oblivion. I'd pass out. I'd wake up and drink myself to oblivion. That's what it was like at the end. Right? It says, once having formed the habit, I would assume that means once I've developed the allergy, right? And found I cannot break it, I lose my reliance on other human beings. I lose my self-confidence. I become very self-conscious, you know, very self-conscious, very selfish, very self-centered. You know, I can only think about me and my condition. It says their problems pile up on them and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. Talk about a description of unmanageability. You know, I was the kind of guy I'd be walking down the street and there could be a couple walking on the other side of the street coming this way. And as our paths cross, all of a sudden they break out into hilarious laughter. They're laughing at me. What are they thinking? What are they saying about me? I was so self-consumed and so crippled by what other people thought about me. It makes me sick to even think about it. If anybody's suffering from that in here, like it's just a constant masquerade, a constant fraud, I know where you're coming from, right? I felt like such a zero. If you could make me feel like a somebody, I'd feel like $1 million. The problem was I'd have to go home and lay my head on a pillow at night and know you were just making nice to a fraud. No wonder I ended up feeling like a complete nobody. This was the manifestation of alcoholism to me, right? Fraud, the emotional appeal seldom suffices. We've all had that. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. They have had to have walked in my shoes and land in my heart when they're talking to me about this thing where I can actually identify exactly that what you're saying happens to me, right? Or there's very little hope. It says in nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves. Even Dr. Silkworth knew this was a spiritual journey. He knew that there was some kind of supernatural aid that had to happen in our life because we were doomed. We were doomed. Notice he says ideals. Well, you know, I used to make up what people were talking about. You know, they'd have these wordy conversations or use these big old words, and I go, yeah, I know what you're talking about, right? And have no idea what they were talking about. I didn't want you to think I was a dummy or that I was stupid or ignorant, so I'd just go along and walk away from the conversation going, what the hell did they talk about, right? Ideals are not ideas. My ideas were really bad. Really bad. An ideal is a concept in its most excellent form. perhaps a principle, you know, integrity, honor, commitment, discipline in its most excellent form. I didn't have any of them in any form, none. Wonder why my life was in the toilet. I had no credit. People were telling me to get out of town. You're not part of this family anymore. I didn't even know what it would be like to even feel what it would like, the reward of being those things. What does that feel like? Well, I saw a man that I believe had those qualities, and I listened very intently to what he could teach me. It was either that or I'm taking myself out. I can't stand another minute of this, right? An ideal. You know, we talk about constitution all the time. We mention it. It's like a fleeting excerpt out of how it works, that they're constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Well, I didn't know quite what that meant either. So I used to, you know, the word constitution was a document in Washington, D.C. What are they talking about? I didn't know that a man or woman had a constitution. I didn't know that we were born with a set of rules and guidelines from which we govern our life. When I became addicted to the world, mine were nothing but selfish and self-centered. That was it. What can I get? I want more of it. That was it. So with a constitution like that, I developed these other beautiful attributes like, you know, greed, lust, pride, ego, sloth. Oh, God. That was my constitution. I wasn't just a habitual liar. I was all of those things, right? I needed an entire psychic change. Very little hope of recovery, or much less anything else, any kind of a happy life. It was a mountain that I knew I couldn't move. It was absolutely a mountain I knew I couldn't move. And nobody in human form was offering that type of mountain to be able to move it. Nobody was offering to. They, you know what I mean? It's like you kind of get to this point where you go, my argument for not pursuing this relationship with God and taking this spiritual path is unfounded. It's a stupid argument. It's a stupid argument, Joe. How well has it been working for you? Let's take a look at what you've been able to produce with all your ability, talent, and skills in the realm of recovery, intimate relationships, success, commitment, authenticity. What's your legacy going to be, Joe? My legacy would have been complete despair, sorrow. What are people going to say when they come to your funeral? You know, they're over your casket. What are they going to be saying? I was leaving a legacy of disappointment and utter despair. Had I died before I got sober, that's what it would have been, period. This is an opportunity to establish a legacy that's outrageous, empowering, never-ending by what we were able to do in Alcoholics Anonymous and carrying the message. And bring people through this deal to establish this relationship that's second to none. It becomes a central fact of your life, my life. But some work had to be done, right? It wasn't just a matter of identifying this. I can take step one and get drunk all the time, right? I believe that the biggest breakdown for people in Alcoholics Anonymous is one that I had. Coming into AA, sticking around, being stark raving sober, having the internal conditions still drive every thought and every action in our life, and just not drinking, and not working the steps. The steps are the process. The steps are the process to go from the caterpillar to the butterfly. That's what we're at. I mean, that's what I wanted. I didn't want to see life the same way, feel life the same way. I didn't want anything the same. I wanted that guy to die. I hated him. So show me a better way or take me out. I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I hate being me. No human being should ever have to go there. But until I get there, I'm not going to listen to you teach me anything. I still think I know what I'm doing. Imagine that. How you doing, Joe? Good. What are you going to do, Joe? Oh, I know what I got to do. What? What? You know what you got to do. Really? I was producing X. All I could produce was X. This sum total of my greatest thoughts was the same thing over and over. A life of nothing but paying prices and loss. Feeling lost. I so desperately wanted Y. I wanted something I didn't know. Something I couldn't imagine. I wanted that guy to die. I didn't want anything to do with that anymore. And I didn't know how to get why. It all begins right here, people. You know? I got to acknowledge to my innermost self that I am truly an alcoholic and I live with a death sentence that's going to take me down. Or have some supernatural, some other than human experience that will remove the obsession of my mind that condemns me to death. I don't know. How long I got to think about that, Joe? Right? There is a solution. But as it says in here, you know, oh boy. You mean I got to go inside? You mean it's not about changing out you or out there or, you know, making sure that I have all this stuff out here? No, it's about it's about deconstructing the individual that I had become. See, I wasn't born to be that way. I had fabricated myself to be that way by my addiction to the world, by my addiction to the stuff. That's what I did, right? I wasn't born that way. Probably the most spiritual being on earth when I was first introduced to it. We were that big. And then I started getting contaminated. I mean, society told me that if I had that, I'd be a better guy. Man, you know what? If you had this, people would look at you like you're that. And you'd have something. Isle Casino, I go by the billboard all the time. Establish a good life. Come to the Seminole Casino. Wow! Doesn't society deem what's gonna fix us or make us something? No. I'm tired of being that person to you. I really was. It was a never-ending battle. I didn't know how to get out of it. Somebody said that there is a solution. But it's all inward. It's all, you know, Carl Jung said, those who look outward dream. Those who look inward awaken. That's what it is. It says this. It says, we feel that the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. Just a beginning. Can't get going until I stop drinking, right? John said this, and I'm going to close with this. He said, Joey says, in the realm of recovery, authentic relationships, intimate relationships, empowering, self-expressed relationships with other people, career, success in career, success in whatever you do. He says, it's what you know that's killing you. And it's what you don't know that's going to save your life. I had to dumb up. He said, this whole thing is all about finding out what you don't know. Because what you do know is providing X. If you want Y, you've got to be taught. You got to submit to somebody being your teacher. You've got to obey them. You've got to do certain things. There's prices you're going to pay. There's sacrifices that must be made. This is not like a casual thing where you're just going to get poofed into the... I tried to get that for 16 years just by going in and saying, well, I'm going to 500 meetings a week. It's like, And I get drunk. I didn't understand it. It's all in here. It's all in this book. Right? The greatest obstacle to learning anything, to me being teachable, is that which I already know. That's what's already there. That's keeping me blind. So I encourage everybody to, you know, if you really got this thing and you got those two pieces of the puzzle, that you become open to being taught. Because until I was, nothing happened. It was what I knew that was taking me back every single time, you know. So next week we'll dive into Bill's story and get into there's a solution. And it's going to be a couple of weeks before I get done with step one. You know, it's not like week one, step one, week two, step two, week three. It doesn't happen like that. There's a lot of information to really become convinced that we're powerless. And they go through it beautifully. So thanks a lot for letting me be here. I really appreciate it.
Let's thank Joe one more time. I'd like to bring up our secretary for the night.
I am your recovered alcoholic, Heather.
Hey, Heather.
In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. I have asked Keith to come up to read the recovered statement to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, my name is Keith. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Keith.
Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we'd be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind, rather than his body. We are now in something where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
''1940-style Big Book sponsorship from forward to second edition Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experienced is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the secret approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I get a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? Is there anyone needing a sponsor? Please raise your hand. Do you guys want to stand up so that we can get you guys back to God? All right, let's get these folks back to God. Please join us Monday nights for our big book study meeting where the book comes alive. Fellowship is at 6:30, and the big book study starts at 7:15. We have CDs, mugs, large print big books, the little red book, and big book dictionaries for sale. We have the 40th big book seminar coming up. It's going to be up in Boca this year, Mother's Day weekend, and they break down the big book all weekend. Then we have the Fellowship of the Spirit coming up. It's going to be here June 22nd and 23rd. Tickets are $35. You can buy them from Mike Chase or online. There's a new meeting AA on Saturday night. And then we're going to have Joe the next 12 weeks. So we meet here every Thursday, starting promptly at 7:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells.
Online at free at alcoholicsandgod.org. I'd like to invite everyone to our Monday night big book study, third floor, this church. And those who wish to thank the speaker, please line up down the center aisle. And let's close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, Godspeed. See you next Monday and Thursday.
Just can't get it right. It
zan, zan, zan. Oh, when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby, baby. Yes, when you're laughing, bah, 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 when you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. So stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby. And I hope.
it shine, 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 let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, 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 let it shine. Shine, 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 let it shine.
This little light of mine.